What can I say about A.J. Jacobs? Well, not much, because I didn't really write anything down. But A.J. is a best-selling author. He has lived biblically. He has gotten very fit. And he has sold a ton of books. So he's an inspiration to us all. A.J. Jacobs.
Hello, everybody. And Randy, I think you're sweet and delicious as well. So thank you for that lovely introduction. I'm going to lean down a little. Not as much as Randy had to. I felt bad for your back, Randy, that you were leaning down. I thought I'd give you the thank you, by the way, for having me here. I am delighted. Thank you to ASJA, a wonderful organization, of which I'm a member. And thank you. I'll give you the 140 character version of my speech, and then I'll, which is three cheers for boldness, experimentation within limits. And I'll expand on that just a little. As a writer, as Randy mentioned, I like to do experiments. So I become a human guinea pig for a while and then report back on the experience. So for instance, a few years ago, I decided to write a book about following all the rules of the Bible for a year. And this came about because I grew up with no religion at all. As I say in the book, I'm Jewish, but I'm Jewish in the same way the Olive Garden is Italian. So, no offense to the Olive Garden. Great breadsticks. But I wanted to learn about my heritage and what to teach my kids. So I decided one way to learn about the Bible was from the inside out, to follow all the rules. So I wrote down all the rules, and there are hundreds of them, and I wanted to follow the famous ones, the Ten Commandments, love your neighbor, be fruitful and multiply. And I was. I had twin boys during that year. So I take, thank you. I will tell them. They'll like that. But I also wanted to follow the lesser known rules. The Bible says that you cannot shave the corners of your beard. I didn't know where the corners were. So I just let the whole thing grow. And by the end, I had this pretty serious topiary hanging from my chin. And to give you a sense, I don't have a picture with me, but to give you a sense of what I looked like, I spent a lot of time at airport security. Now, Leviticus also says that you should stone adulterers. So I figured I should at least try to do that. And I did. I stoned one adulterer, and it was very small stones, pebbles, so no one got injured. And it was a fascinating year, and it did change my life for the better. After I did stop stoning adulterers, I shaved my beard, but I've kept much. And just to give you one very quick example, it taught me a lot about gratitude and the idea of being thankful for the hundreds of things that go right every day, as opposed to focusing on the three or four that go wrong. So thank you, in honor of that, thank you to ASJ for making everything go right today. Now, I did, during the year, I learned a lot about the Bible, and a lot about writing. So since this is a writing conference, I thought I'd give you a couple of things. First, I learned that the importance of proofreading. Because in 1631 in England, there was a famous edition of the Bible. And they had one word missing. Happened to be an important word. It was in the seventh commandment, and the word was not. So the commandment read, thou shalt commit adultery. So you can imagine the next day all these English guys are going up to their neighbors' wives and be like, you see what it said? You know, that's what God tells, you know, shall we commence fornication? So it is, proofreading is not a joke, people. We got to be thankful for the proofreaders. The editor of that Bible actually got thrown in jail. So we should also be thankful we don't live in 17th century England. There is also some interesting writing advice in the Bible from King Solomon, who wrote Ecclesiastes. And he wrote Ecclesiastes 12:12, be careful, for writing books is endless, and much study wears you out. So I love that. It's the first recorded instance of a writer complaining about his deadline. And I am proud. I am proud to continue this biblical tradition, and I think all of you should be too. I wrote another book about reading the encyclopedia from A to Z and trying to learn everything in the world. And this came about because my dad, when I was a kid, he loved learning, he loved reading, so he started to read the encyclopedia. He didn't quite finish. He made it up to the middle of the letter B, around Bolivia. So I thought I should try to finish what he began and remove that black mark from our family history. So I did. I spent a year and a half just reading all the time. And it was a fascinating year. I learned a lot, a little too much, perhaps. My wife started to fine me $1 for every irrelevant fact I inserted into conversation. So, but again, I learned there was lots of inspiring writer stories in the encyclopedia. And just to give you one example, I read about an 18th century poet named William Cowper. And William's friend challenged him to write an epic poem about the most boring topic possible, which he decided was couches. And so William Cowper took him up on this challenge, and he wrote an epic poem about couches. And it was wonderful, and it was a huge hit. And so this makes me realize, you know, the takeaway is, you can, if you write with enough passion and style, then you can make every topic interesting, even sofas. Now, all of the stories in the encyclopedia about writers were not blue sky, were not happy. You know, I learned a lot of disturbing facts about writers. We are, you might have noticed, we're not the most well-adjusted people in the world. For instance, Edgar Allan Poe, I love him, but when he was 27, he got married to his 13-year-old first cousin, so which I find as creepy as any of his stories, and he was sort of Jerry Lee Lewis, but 100 years early. Now, my most recent book is about my quest to be as healthy as possible. So I did all sorts of diet and exercise and sleep. I tried to reform everything. One thing I learned, writing a book about health is not very healthy. Writing in general is not a very healthy profession. For one thing, we are seated most of the day. And you might have read, sitting is frustratingly bad for us. I mean, some of these articles that you read are very disturbing. They're, you know, they say, if you are reading this article sitting down, you will be dead by the end of this sentence. But it's not that bad. But it's true that extended sitting is not good for our heart or our metabolism. So I tried to get up every half hour and walk around a bit. I also, at the end, I took it even further. I bought a treadmill. And I put my computer on top of the treadmill, and I wrote the book while walking. So it took me about 1,200 miles, so from New York to Arkansas, basically. And I still do that. I love my treadmill. And by the way, I am not coordinated, so if I can do it, I think anyone can. And I actually have competitions. There's a growing group of other treadmill desk writers. My friend Rebecca Skloot, who wrote The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, she has one. And we compete on steps every day. And she is kicking my ass. She does like 20,000 steps a day. So she is going to be immortal. Now, treadmills aside, this is a bizarre time in the history of writing. Creatively, I think it is the most exciting time in writing because there are so many outlets. Anyone can be a publisher. There are heaps of innovative ways to connect with our audience. And you can experiment with visuals and sound. So it's creatively extremely exciting. Financially, not as exciting. It's a very challenging time to make a living as a writer, as you might have noticed. But I am hopeful that if we are bold and experimental, there will be a bright future for writers. And I thought I'd give you 5 very brief tips about writing that I've learned from my experiments, and hopefully they will be helpful to you as well. The first idea is to be bold in your networking. Bold but smart. Last night I came up with a phrase, strategic chutzpah, trademark. And there was an example of this I learned in the encyclopedia. The poet Langston Hughes, when he started out, he was a busboy at a hotel. And the great famous poet Václav Havel came to stay at the hotel, and Langston Hughes served him breakfast. And when he served him breakfast, he slipped him some poems. And, so while Havel was eating his waffles, he would read the poems. And I actually don't know if it was waffles, but everyone loves waffles, so I'm assuming, probably. And that's how Langston Hughes got discovered. It worked. Now, I am not Václav Havel, but something similar happened to me. I was writing my book about the Bible, trying to live by all the rules, and I got an email from a freshman at Brown University. And it was a really sharp, well-researched, well-written email, and he said he wanted to be a writer. And he said he was coming to New York over the summer and would like to volunteer to be my assistant in his off hours when he wasn't being a barista. So I remember, since I was following all the rules of the Bible, in the Old Testament, it does condone Hebrew slavery. So thankfully, slavery is illegal in the tri-state area. But I thought, what is the closest thing to being a slave? An intern. Sort of similar, working for free. So I said to him, okay, you can be my assistant as long as I can call you my slave. And he said, all right. And he came and worked for me, and he was wonderful. He was a great researcher. He made Ezekiel bread for me, which is the bread in the Bible. And I took him on a research trip to Jerry Falwell's church. That was part of my book, to go see how other people interpreted the Bible. And he was fascinated. And on the way back, he said to me, I have an idea. What if I transferred from Brown, which is the most liberal college in America, and spent a semester at Jerry Falwell's college, Liberty, which is the most conservative. And then I could write about it. And sort of my semester abroad in evangelical land. And I said, that's a very interesting idea. And I connected him with my agent, and he wrote a great proposal. He did it. He wrote the book. It's a terrific book. And it's very balanced and nuanced. That's what I love about it. It's not a hatchet job, not one-sided. It shows the good and the bad. It's called The Unlikely Disciple, and his name is Kevin Roos. And now Kevin is a superstar writer at New York Magazine. And so the point is, I wish I had been as smart as Kevin when I was young, because he didn't just blanket the market with a bunch of form letters. You know, he didn't even go through alumni relations. He researched and targeted and wrote a very strategic email. And it worked. Now, I will say that there is a fine line between strategic chutzpah and stalking. So I just throw that out as a caveat. But Kevin never crossed the line. All right, so number two is that I recommend being bold with your schedule. Show your schedule who's boss. Because for a long time, I was at the mercy of my schedule. I would have no time in the day because there's always some quasi-emergency, right? There's always, a phone call or an email to return. And I was finding I had no time in the day to come up with ideas. And ideas are the lifeblood of our business, especially now, because we have to be entrepreneurs now. We have to come up with our own projects. There, with very few exceptions, editors are not going to be assigning us things. We have to pitch. So what I do now is I try to allot 15 minutes a day to brainstorming new ideas. So I turn off the cell phone, turn off the computer, and maybe put some books or magazines around and just brainstorm. And this has been very fruitful for me. And a lot of ideas do come randomly, say in the shower, but there's also something to be said for making creativity more regimented. And it sounds paradoxical, but it works. Because if you don't carve out time, the day will slip away as you deal with minutia. And I once did an experiment. I once wrote an article about what I call unitasking. So the opposite of multitasking and just doing one thing at a time. And the weird thing was, it was actually more productive when I was unitasking. I was more efficient. And at one point, I literally tied myself to my chair so I couldn't get up. And that's actually much harder to do when you're on a treadmill, I found. And you don't really need to go that far. But I do recommend sitting down and unitasking for every day about creativity. All right, so number three is be bold in helping others. And the New York Times magazine just ran a cover story about how kindness and helping others is the key to business success. And I love this idea. You know, some days I am better at this than other days, but I think it's a great goal to strive for because I think if you are helpful to others, they will be helpful to you. And I actually, I do a lot of blurbing. In fact, I have a reputation for being a blurb whore. And I actually, I don't like that word. I don't get paid, so I'm more of a blurb slut. And but I do tend to blurb quite a bit, and I get in trouble for this. In fact, the New York Times reviewer, Dwight Garner, tweeted a few months ago, he wrote, "Half the crap galleys I get are blurbed by one human, A.J. Jacobs." And then his hashtag was, "Time for an intervention." And it got so bad that I mistakenly used the exact same blurb on two books. And they were both, the book, I got sent a book about the environment. So I wrote, buy this book, read it, compost it. And I was like, that's not a bad blurb. So I send it in. And then like a month later, I look back and I realize I used the exact same joke on another book about the environment. And I had just forgotten it. So I call the publisher. I'm like, you gotta change it. They're like, too late. So I was all nervous someone would notice and make fun of me, but I had my answer prepared. I said, I was going to say, well, I was just recycling the joke because we've got to preserve our precious joke resources. But I think that, and my agents and editors have said that I have to stop blurbing so much. So I have pulled back. You know, I'm not abstinent, but I do it less. But I actually think blurbing is a good thing because it's a tough business out there. And anything, I don't even know if blurbs help. I certainly don't know if mine help. But I think that if you can help someone in little way, then it's going to pay back double for you later. Thank you. Number four is, I recommend being bold in experimenting with new forms of media. And I'm still trying to follow this advice because it's hard. You know, I come from the days when you actually wanted to get paid for writing, but you actually got paid for everything you wrote. So when Twitter started and Facebook, I was very reluctant to embrace them. But I've tried to change because I do think that if you use Twitter right, it can actually help you get new gigs that will eventually end up paying. And you might have heard about a writer named Adam Mansbach, who got the idea, he got an idea for his best-selling book from Facebook, actually. He posted on Facebook a joke saying that he was exhausted by his kids and that he was going to write a book called Go the Fuck to Sleep. And he was joking, but all of his friends responded and said, you know, you should actually write that. And he did. And it was a number one bestseller. Also, there's a writer named Baratunde Thurston, and he wrote a book called How to Be Black. And that got his start as well on a conversation on Twitter. So you're not necessarily giving stuff away for free. You're starting a conversation that might plant seeds and actually turn into something that will get you money in the future. Another form that I'm trying to embrace is video. And I have very mixed feelings about this. Let me tell you a very quick story about the start of my career. For my very first book, I sent a proposal to my agent. And he sent it to the publisher. And the agent calls me and says, the publisher is very interested. They want to make a bid, but they just want to see a picture, a photo. And I was like, a picture? What's going on? And my agent says, oh, they just want to make sure that you don't have two heads, you know, so that you can go on a talk show if you need to. And I said, all right. So I go to Walmart, and I have my photo taken with the fan blowing my hair. And I send the photo to my agent. He calls back 2 days later. I talk to the publisher. They're going to pass. I was like, what? I thought, I'm not even good looking enough to be an author. You know, I'm not trying to be a soap opera star here. people? I mean, I was thinking, like, did Herman Melville, did he have to work on his abs? Like, you know, did he have to have highlights? So the whole point of being a writer is trying to avoid people. So so you can see it's still a little bit of a sore point. I won't name the publisher, Crown Publisher. But here's the sad part. This is sad but true, is that they were actually a little ahead of their time, because it is becoming increasingly important for authors to become presenters of their own work. And you don't have to be handsome or beautiful. That's where I disagree with them. But I do think it's important that you be more comfortable in front of people and in front of the camera. Because in the future, authors, and very near future, we're going to have to get income from multiple streams. And one of those is appearances. And we might have to be more like musicians who make a lot of their money from live shows. So it's not necessarily a trend I approve of, but I do believe it's the reality of the marketplace. And if you want an example of this, you can do worse than John Green. I don't know if you know that author, a young adult author, and he's brilliant. And he produced a series of videos that you should check out online. And he has followers in the millions. And he's a great writer. So to be able to do both is wonderful. And part of I'm not a natural like John Green. So part of the trick I find is the whole idea of fake it till you make it, which I learned from the Bible. I don't think it's in those words in the Bible, but if you pretend that you love being in front of the camera, then eventually, it will take hold. There's a phrase, it's easier to act your way into a new way of thinking than to think your way into a new way of acting. And I love that because I think it's true. And when I was doing the Bible book, you know, I didn't feel compassionate. I didn't feel like visiting my friend in the hospital, but I would force myself to. And then I would see myself in the hospital and it would trick my brain. And I would say, oh, I'm a compassionate person. And you become more compassionate. And it's a very powerful tool. They talk about it in cognitive behavioral psychology a lot. Number five is, this one is mostly for memoir writers, but I think for everyone, is to be bold in telling the truth. And I try to encourage that to people to be bold, especially about yourself and your own flaws, and being willing to open up about what's wrong with you and your mistakes. And it's very liberating, and it also helps you bond with the reader. I think that that is one of, if you say the most embarrassing thing, then the reader is instantly engaged. And I do prefer to talk about my own flaws, but if you do talk about other people's flaws, I have one important tip. Appeal to their vanity. And this I learned because in my first book, the one about reading the encyclopedia, my brother-in-law was my nemesis. And he's an interesting character. I think he'd be okay with me describing him this way. He's a douchebag. He knows it. So he is the ultimate know-it-all. He went to Harvard, and he loves to lord it over you and make you feel dumb. So when I wrote about him in my book, the first thing I mentioned was that he was good-looking and that he had a full head of hair, which is true, and that's all he focuses on. He doesn't care about anything. So whenever you write about someone and you're not really sure how they're going to take it, I do recommend opening with that they are handsome or beautiful. And then you can just say whatever you want. And by the way, during that book, I went on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, because I had all this knowledge, so I wanted to see what I could do with it. And I got to the $32,000 question, and it was a biology question. And my brother-in-law was a biology major at Harvard, so I called him as my lifeline, my phone-a-friend, and he blew it. He didn't know the answer. And it was terrible. I mean, it was very bittersweet, because I humiliated myself on national television, but I brought him down with me. So it was kind of exciting. And I bring it up every time I see him. Where's my $32,000? And he still hasn't. And then finally, in the theme of boldness, I would say, I mentioned earlier that I think we should be bold and experimental, but with limits. And what I mean is that I love being bold with method, being bold with our topics, and being bold with telling the truth. But I think that we should not be so bold with our conclusions. Or, let me put it a more positive way, we should be bold enough to show that reality is messy and complicated, and it's never one-sided. Even Eric, my brother-in-law, he's actually got some wonderful qualities, and I actually like hanging out with him. So we should, it's a very easy way to get traffic and readers by saying, you know, TK is the worst movie in America, or this politician is the most evil politician in Washington, D.C. But I think there is a hunger for people who can represent that the world is complicated. And if you can represent that in an entertaining and balanced and insightful way, then you will get readers. But again, that's just my opinion. The truth is probably more complicated. So with that, I thank you and have a great conference. I'll be around and happy to answer more questions. Thank you.